Committee of the Ways and Means Human Resource Subcommittee. We're actually on the subcommittee in a sense. And we're going to go back to what we began yesterday. And I'm sitting on top of my... this is, you're Mr. Bjornsson.
Very good.
Did I say it right, Bjornsson?
Very good.
And so I think that you're going to, the community partnerships, you're going to continue with your presentation that you were not through. Is that correct? But you know what? Yesterday I didn't let Katie through. And so I'm going to let her give us what... I'm sorry.
Actually, there's been enough said about the agency, but what I do want to point out is what's in the packet, which is there was a budget note from 1997, which I've included in your packet, and to go to the e-board and report, and I've also included the minutes from that e-board. In addition, there was an audit report done on the computer center general controls review.
Yeah.
And so
I apologize. Okay. Which packet are we looking at?
Here, right close to that yellow sheet, right here, right there. There you go. There's the budget.
Thank you.
I apologize. And it's for your convenience, and actually Doug told me this has changed a little bit, I put this yellow sheet in so you can kind of keep track of who belongs to which section and how many, you know, the overall scheme of support services, so you can kind of follow along with that. And then the second page is just kind of a reminder. We had given a presentation earlier, and we talked about the fact that the support-wide services is support services is funded by other funds primarily. Well, those other funds are from 92% are from assessments from the division, so that does break out into general funds, other funds, and federal funds. So I just wanted to ask you that. So that's really all I have to say.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm going to preempt Lenny for just a couple of minutes, because I want to share with you some information. I attended with some other folks a meeting in Polk County. We attended at 12 today, and there were 100 people gathered in the Monmouth County Library to talk with us about all the success in Polk County around service integration. What a timely conversation, and I was sat there for 2 hours listening to them describe all their programs and projects and the partnerships that are going on with the state, and had wished that you all would have been able to sit there with us and listen to it, because we had both the police chiefs there from both cities of Independence and Monmouth. We had every principal from every middle school, every elementary school, the judges, all the county commissioners, businessmen and women, all packed into this library to talk to a number of us as state agencies about what's been accomplished because of our willingness to begin to do a lot more partnering. And I stole one of their principal demonstration devices just for a minute to show you. They created this in the county, and it shows the level of support is what they call it. So the service is down the center here and all the connections. And just to give you an example, what they call a service integration, which includes all the stuff that Lenny does, you can think that they're going in other places in the park, but they're not, but they're really out of CPC. But the connection between service integration, of course, the Hope County Mental Health, Hope County, what they call their own civic integration project, the volunteer program, the Hope County, the Grand Bronx Tribe, the Water District, the schools, the whole Monmouth School District, the Marion Hope Health, Healthy Start program, the Dallas Community Hospital has a connection with civic integration, their local council, the Evangelical Church of Dallas, the Paul Church. I mean, you can go down to each of their services. I don't know how long it took. Ties what they're doing to our integration projects and other state projects too. They can talk about transportation initiatives in the county, housing initiatives, the education of minority youth in Polk County. Anyway, they did a great job, and I can't capture the enthusiasm that came out of that group of 100 folks there explaining what they've been able to accomplish because of really different kinds of strategies the state's engaged in now. And I thought it was important for you to know that. I mean, you couldn't be there and stuff, but we have another person who could speak today that was there, who can Stephanie was here, but I grabbed this on my way out of their conference room and said, I need to sit the one out. I'm choosing Representative Volpe. If you have a comment about the connections here and the redundancy,
mm-hmm.
one of the things that one of the school principals said is invaluable in all the crimson breaks in Polk County is the capacity for the county to make sure there wasn't redundant activity, to be able to sort through who was doing what, and have only one agency, whether it was the county or the city, because they were there also, or the state providing the services, and then use the money that otherwise would have been redundant in other services.
Right.
And she was very articulate in explaining how they managed to do that by all together.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Madam Chair, just out of curiosity, say 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, how would that chart have looked?
This chart would have no thread to it. Probably. The connection 5 years ago
uh-huh.
would probably not have been here. And if they were, there'd be very few of them. But uh-huh. these connections, these threads that connect all the services are all working the last part of the 6 years.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that Polk County has been working on this about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 years ago, there would have been some of those connections, but they were mainly based on personalities
mm-hmm.
and an individual's personal reaching out to each other. And when that person left, then that was over.
The effort went with it.
And Donna Middleton was the director of their human resources, who is now the state director.
Mm-hmm.
And she was one of the people that began really working hard to put this together.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things at that time, Children's Services, some of our state agencies were very reluctant to get involved. We were too busy, we had too much to do.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We only work with these serious cases. We don't want to. You know, we don't want to get involved in this less serious stuff, and Donna was a real leader in pulling it together. But I just think they really could be commended that they stayed on task, they didn't get discouraged, and they kept on going.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just very impressed with what they've done.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that digression.
Thank you for sharing that.
Turn it over to Lenny.
Chair Cusco and members of the committee, thanks so much for the extra time today to continue our presentation on the community partnership team. Very pleased to have the time to walk through some of our program areas of responsibility. If you have the notebook in front of you from yesterday, I just want to point out or review just a couple points on page 10 and then continue to look through the subsequent pages. Indeed, on page 10, the community partnership team has some areas of work that I'll talk about in more detail, but those include service integration projects, volunteer services across Oregon, reduced adolescent pregnancy partnerships, Oregon lifespan respite, and outcome measurement. We also, for the department, as you may know, provide leadership and training around confidentiality across the department and to many of our local partners as they're working together on the same client. One point about outcome measurement that I wanted to reflect upon for you is that many of you may be familiar with management by objectives or how small business or corporations use measurable objectives. Measurable objectives, by the way, are very similar to what we call measurable outcomes in human services. Those are synonyms if you are interested in that point. On page 11, there is a map, and I'd like to refer you to Polk County as today's example. Yesterday, I talked about Deschutes County. The Polk County there on the left-hand side of the chart has two circles, two service integration projects that we help support. We have a local CPT office that focuses on volunteer services. There is a lifespan respite network going on in Polk County, as well as a reduced adolescent pregnancy program a coalition there in Polk County. You can see the symbols and the legend on the lower right-hand side. And in fact, the details about Polk County are on page 91, back in the appendix. And in that appendix, you'll see some of the details of what the services and activities that we do in Polk County. Our local manager there is Judy Bowen. At the end of, maybe the next half hour or so, I'd like Judy to come up and talk with you a little bit about how this works on the ground with large charts like what we have on the left and other people-to-people kinds of connections that Judy and other folks are working on. On page 91, you'll see some of the detail about our work in Polk County. yesterday at the hour of 3, I was talking about some of the accomplishments on pages 12 and 13 of the community partnership team, one of which is the Deschutes Family Access Network, about the middle of the page on page 12, where that network of service centers in 11 elementary buildings is generating a ton, a lot of, however you want to quantify it, 1,500 and some services of health, physical health, dental services for students and their families in those elementary schools in Central Oregon. On page 14, I'll talk a little bit about the details of service integration. But I also like to point out at your setting there in your packet, you should have a collection of support letters from some of our local customers. It looks like this on the front is a note from Sonoma County. One of the things the community partnership team also does is support and staff the local government advisory committee for the entire department. The chair of the local government advisory committee is Sue Cameron, chair of the Sonoma County Commissioners. He has a letter of support on the top, some of our other customers, a service integration, lifespan respite, and a large integration project on the last couple pages from the Juvenile Justice Consortium of Central and Eastern Oregon. On page 14, service integration is one of the areas of responsibility that we work on. We support or contribute to both finances as well as technical assistance, problem solving, connections to Salem agencies, with 37 different projects across Oregon. These projects all work to solve human services problems in a more of a collective way, weaving together a variety of agencies, their services, their staff, their policies. On the bottom of page 14, I give you a little bit of a breakout of the types of service integration projects that we help support. Many of them are family centers. You may be familiar with family centers in your county. That would include family centers in Tualatin, North Clackamas, Wolf Creek, Little Burg, and Josephine County, as well as the Family Resource Center in Roosevelt High School in St. John, neighborhood of North Portland. Multidisciplinary teams is another way in which organizations come together to coordinate and integrate their services. We see people doing it through buildings and working in centers. We also see people doing it through teams. Some of the most prolific teams in Oregon are in Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. We contribute to a project coordinated by the ESD of Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties using Medicaid reimbursement funds. These services are coordinated through youth service teams, teachers, counselors, other service providers in 13 different settings in those three counties, overseen in each case by a local steering committee as to what the priorities are. I would note that every service integration project that we contribute to, every local office of ours, every lifespan respite program has a work plan. And each work plan has outcome measures. These outcome measures help us understand the results that the local projects are generating and how we are investing our time and money, what kind of results are we getting. One of our, as I mentioned, a juvenile justice service integration project works with 16 different Eastern Oregon counties on how those 16 counties, working with our AFS division, Services for Children and Families, Mental Health, Public Health, Oregon Youth Authority, work on collectively managing their support and their work with kids on probation, kids not yet on probation, kids coming out of parole. How do we have a juvenile justice system in those 16 counties? On page 15, let me just point out a couple results. In the middle of that box on page 15, a single phone call to the Polk Family Resource Network, of which Judy can talk more about, can provide information referral to make sure families don't fall through the cracks. Every month, they help over 100 families solve problems like finding a physician, who will accept the Oregon Health Plan, locating mentoring for a child, or finding funding and resources for families and all their needs. On page 16, and make note of the results from the Roosevelt Family Resource Center in St. John's. Over 30 service providers meet every week in Roosevelt High School to sort out the supports and services and problem solving they can work on together for the kids and the families in Roosevelt High School. The success story on page 16 talks about a grandmother in Independence recently became a legal guardian for her three grandchildren, all of whom suffered significant abuse in their home. The children had many needs, and the grandmother had many questions. The Polk County Central Service Integration Team, much of what Gary pointed out here today in this web of support, brainstormed ideas and connected her with Modern Grandparents, a support group, the Oregon Health Plan, which led to counseling and help through the services to children and families, SDF. Another major part of the CPT is volunteer services. Many of you have heard of the DHR volunteer program. It's still alive and well. It's a part of the CPT. Many of you may know the person that has been working for us for many years in that volunteer project or volunteer office locally for over 30 years that's been going on. What's unique about the volunteer program is while we run it from a state staff, the priorities and the local design of what gets done is steered by a local committee of service providers and other stakeholders locally. Some of the examples of what our volunteers do on the bottom of page 17, transporting clients, locating resources such as clothing, work experience for those who need employment, tutoring and interpreting, office assistance for social service agencies, lots of transportation, as we have noted. Our volunteers are well supported, in my opinion. We are able to recruit them, select them, screen them, and support them through ongoing problem solving quite effectively. A criminal history check, sometimes involving FBI fingerprints, is used. Our volunteers, as they are registered, are provided with limited insurance and tort liability coverage by the state. Many times our volunteers work in not-for-profit organizations, as well as doing driving, senior centers, child care centers, mentoring, lunch buddies. You may have heard of some of those terms in your town or neighborhood that are coordinated by our local CPT office. Volunteerism results at the bottom of page 18. You can see how, by our calculations in 98, 29,000 persons volunteered with 950,000 hours of service, equaling the work of 460 full-time paid staff, saving Oregonians about $10 million.
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, I guess I'm going to ask, that is state efforts alone. Does that include any of the county services in that? Volunteerism.
Madam Chair, Representative Loken, if I understand your question correctly, those are the volunteers that we register through our state CPT offices.
Oh, okay. So that the county is separate from that. Yeah.
On page 19, you can see our steady growth in our charts on volunteer hours and client transportation. Majority of the clients transported by our volunteers are clients of DHR or DHR's partners of not-for-profits or perhaps county agencies. I believe our steady growth has come from our focus on what the local customers, what their priorities are, and what they really want. Customers like the local mental health authority or the senior center or a child care center or the adult and family services. Some success stories I relate to you on page 20. The little one there, a Jobs Plus employee worked in Josephine County CPT office for 4 months. She retired at her first interview into a part-time position. Not long afterwards, she took a full-time position with an insurance agency and soon became an agent. Her experience with the CPT helped her develop the independence, confidence, and skills to become a successful insurance agent in her community. A lot of folks, when they're returning to work, need a supportive place where, like our office, to begin revitalization of skills and confidence and work habits, as well as receiving all that different types of social supports that our offices locally are able to coordinate. A third part of the community partnership team that I'd like to talk about is on page 21. We worked hard with the RAP Steering Committee of the State of Oregon, of which Representative Ross is a member, as well as in many locations, 28, I believe, around Oregon. We are supporting the development of what I would like to call a flourishing local group working on teen pregnancy prevention. That group flourishes when it brings many perspectives together. Chamber of Commerce, Planned Parenthood, the Lutheran Church, Adult and Family Services, Health Department, and the like. Our objective in the CPT is to make sure every, and my vision is that every town and neighborhood in Oregon, if they like, would have a flourishing teen pregnancy prevention coalition. Our job is to support the development of those coalitions. One of the ways we do that, in fact, is that by using AmeriCorps grants from the AmeriCorps, we have 12, what I would call student interns, supporting or helping those local coalitions implement their strategy. Moving on to our other area of responsibility, which came to its last session in House Bill 2013, was the Oregon Lifespan Respite Program. Again, here is where a local group of stakeholders, service providers, families, get together and design a network, in this case, of how they're going to provide or how they're going to coordinate respite services from birth to death. For kids with autism or the caregivers of kids with autism or caregivers or folks with Alzheimer's and everything in between, how do these local networks, currently operating in 13 counties, coordinate and organize all the different respite providers and systems going on in their net, in their community? We're using state general funds to support those local networks. We view it as a contribution to their cause. They undoubtedly gather other resources from other organizations to put their networks together. You can see that on the bottom of page 22, a single point of contact for families to access respite care is the crucial first step. Currently, as you may know in your communities, we are rolling out phase two of the respite networks. We hope to add 12 new networks or contribute to 12 new networks this spring and summer and fall, so that a year from now, we will have some 25 networks really percolating out there, organizing respite services, connecting families with respite providers that meet their needs, organizing stipends, volunteers, and other ways of paying for those respite providers. On the page of 23, in the middle of the page, I would highlight that over 450 local state partners have participated in the 13 current Lifespan Respite Coalition. What that means is every network locally is overseen by a council of a wide range of stakeholders, some of them service providers, a lot of them families. In fact, your statute specifies a large percentage of each local council that oversees the project have to be families or customers to use respite services. Our job, on the bottom of page 23, is to help coordinate statewide support, provide technical assistance and expertise, assisting the networks in building partnerships. Sometimes it's easier for a state entity to be available to resolve local problems because the local coalition gets stuck. And that may be just a temporary thing we might do. We might, in the longer term, provide expertise on how to organize stipends for lifespan respite care. And we, as I mentioned, we contribute some funding to the local network. Some results and success stories from Lifespan Respite are on page 24 and 25. So far in our first 6 months, the first half of fiscal year 99, 352 families were registered to receive respite care services, and 261 respite referrals were completed. Be aware that in some communities, the idea of networking together all their respite services was new, exciting, but they hadn't done it yet, and it took them a while to organize their council, organize how they were going to do the referrals, set up a database, connect and learn how to connect families and the caregivers or respite care for the caregivers in a way that met their local conditions. 23% of those served were listed as at risk of abuse or neglect as the primary reason they needed respite care. 292 rescue providers are screened and trained and are now listed in local registries. 14% of those rescue providers are volunteers. I think the success story on the top of page 25 is typical and touching. In rural Baker County, a family caring for two boys, ages 7 and 9, both with autism, requested help in finding a provider to care for the boys while the parent traveled to the nearest town to do weekly grocery shopping. The unique communication and behavioral needs of the children and living over an hour from the city made it difficult to find someone to help. A relative who knew the boys was recruited and submitted to one 10-hour day each week, allowing the parent to travel to town to do shopping and simple errands. A small stipend was provided to the relative provider. Relief was provided for the parents and not having to struggle with a simple weekly task that most people take for granted.
Lenny, I'm going to interrupt Lenny here. He's given you, I think, the human side of these success stories. What we haven't reflected here and maybe would have difficulty doing is the cost to the state that's avoided by having a respite care system in the state that lets families continue to care for the children and their parents, in some cases, who they want to remain in their own home. This family he's cited, a family with two children with autism, just getting away to do grocery shopping is a pretty fundamental thing. But there are other families who are getting their respite care just in order to get away to have some time, some personal time, husbands and wives who need some personal time together away from a profoundly disabled child or a profoundly disabled adult, a parent that they're trying to care for. Because without giving them that time, particularly in this case of the kids, we could easily have those kids. We could have those in our care at far greater cost than what we spend for a little bit of respite care. So this initiative that was started last session by the legislature, as Lenny said, the actual bill was passed last session, phased in all 36 counties. It called for us to do at least 12 in the current biennium, and we brought 13 counties up. This biennium is supposed to be called for 12 in the next biennium and 12 in the old, biennium. So that by the end of 03, in all 36 counties, there is a full-blown lifespan respiratory program. But I can't emphasize enough the side of it that avoids some costs for us and keeps these children and adults in families where they can be well cared for and loved in a natural family setting. So I don't want us to lose the notion that this has some real fiscal impact too.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Our Director Weeks just made the point I was going to make, but it's something that I ran across personally with some of the folks who had been here before the committee on other issues. Gene Thomas, the parents of some of the medically fragile children, have all communicated to me how much that service is important to them. And exactly this point, it's that they're 24-hour day caregivers in the home, and all they're asking for is a brief break once in a while to take care of other business rather than having these individuals become institutionalized and they get far greater cost to the state. I think it's a great program. Very happy to see its implementation.
I would just echo those comments. I know I'm familiar with families in Washington County. We probably all echo that because it is, for one thing, it's good that those families want to remain intact, and they want to care for their loved ones, but it is difficult sometimes because it's a 24-hour-a-day job, and you wouldn't think it would be such a big deal to get away for, like, grocery shopping and so forth, but of course, just put yourself in that position sometime and think about not being free to be able to do that. So it is a great savings, really, to the state, and I think it's just a good ethic that we can try to help these families to stay together when they want to. And and I agree that this lifespan respite program is very good.
Madam Chair, I would add that that spirit that you speak about has been captured, I think, by our staff throughout the state as they're excited about helping support these networks of families, just like their neighbors, ready to put this together.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Senator Hughes?
Thank you. I think this is a great service. But my question is, do families pay for this respite care on a sliding scale basis?
Chair Kutub and Senator Yee, in the respite care provided locally, the network puts together many different ways of which the respite care is provided for. Sometimes it might be provided for by a different agency. The respite network itself may not be paying that bill, or maybe maybe there's volunteer respite. It comes in many different ways, and a challenge for the network is to organize all of those different ways in which respite care is provided for. Sometimes, indeed, parents or the caregivers do pay for it directly. So there's a wide range of payment methods for respite care, and the network's job is to make all of that work easier for the parents who call this one central place and say, I need a helping hand, I need a break, and what are the different ways in which we might be able to get this paid for?
Madam Chair, I think it's wonderful to have the service available for the families who can afford it. I mean, let them pay for the service.
Indeed. Madam Chair, I think as Frank said, that does happen. We try not to micromanage the local respite care network, county based. As Frank said, we try to let them do their business. I guess it's not just as much as paying for it, but it's also being able to assure these families when they call the respite care hotline, they're going to get someone who knows how to care for the child or parent that's in the home. I mean, you can't go next door and get a neighbor to come over and take care of two autistic children. And that was really a big part of the original development of this system, was to be able to assure you, if you call the respite care system, that someone would be sent to your home who was well qualified to care for the individual, who didn't have a criminal record, who wasn't a child abuser or a child molester or anything else like that. All these people that are on the registry have been screened and are certified as being well trained and able to take care of the person that they're coming into your home to care for.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would turn to the letters of support that we have. I would just walk through them briefly to illustrate they come from several different parts of our community partnership team. The cover sheet from Tillamook County speaks to our work with the Local Government Advisory Committee, as well as Service Integration. The following two letters are from Service Integration sites in Tualatin and in North Clackamas County, or what Representative Loken may know as the Litcomb neighborhood. Senator Shields would know the East County Caring Community, where they're working a variety of service integration teams. Another letter from the Rogue Family Center, which is an integrated site of over 40 different agency staffers working in a town called White City outside of Medford. We also have a letter from the Marion County Lifespan Respite Care Network from Leanne Riles, the coordinator of the network here in Marion County. And in closing, the last letter is from what we call as COJAC, the Central and Eastern Oregon Juvenile Justice Consortium of those 16 juvenile departments that I mentioned earlier, working together to better support those kids in their system. With that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to introduce Judy Bowen, our local staff, who worked for many years in Washington County and now is with us in Polk County. We're pleased to have her here and proud of Judy's ability and capacity to focus on all that we do in the community partnership team, everything from teen pregnancy coalitions on one hand, the service integration, lifespan respite, and that web of supports over there that Polk County is working on putting together and organizing and understanding how it supports families.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to speak here about a little bit of what I do. I too was there this morning. I actually talked about some of the programs that I've got, and I was really intrigued with what they did as far as the web goes. We are involved in a lot of collaborative approaches here.
I'm with the Department of Human Resources Community Partnership Team. I've been with the program for 9 years. I do have 27 years of social work experience. I worked back in the 80s with Senator Shields developing homeless shelters, and I was his first case manager at his church shelter. And back in the 70s, I did a lot of grassroots organizing with community action programs. I was in the Albina Action Center way back in the 70s in Northeast Portland, developing community gardens and weatherization workshops. So I love where I'm at now with Community Partnership Team. I feel that I'm the eyes and ears in the community, and I can help build neighborhoods, I can connect, and I can do a lot of community development. We are interested in kids excelling and making connections and making families self-sufficient. I've got over 200 volunteers making this happen on a daily basis, and we do manage those volunteers and give them recognition. I'll talk a little bit about Washington County because we have been touching on Polk County. I was in Washington County for 8 years, helped develop Lunch Buddy program, which is a mentoring program in 14 elementary schools. I was able to get Nike to take on 3 schools right around them, Hollywood Video down in the Tualatin schools, Farmers Insurance. So we had over 300 volunteers from these corporations connecting into the schools. And that was a tough one to do in Washington County, but I think it was just getting out there, connecting with the right people and making things happen. We are definitely outcome-based, so we do survey both volunteers, parents, and the kids to see how this is working. And the school personnel did say that there's a increased attendance in the school, and plus fewer referrals to the principal's office. So we are making a lot of leadway with the Lunch Buddy program. I have Lunch Buddy programs throughout Polk County now, too. Started up a really unique program in Washington County, and it was in residential group homes, 4 residential group homes for boys, and I called it Dinner Buddies. It was just a way for people on their way home from work to come and maybe have a meal with these kids. I had one volunteer who was in computer, and he didn't have children of his own, and I thought, oh boy, Walt, what am I going to do with Walt? And yet I placed him in a home, and Walt was a vegetarian. Well, the kids took on Walt. They planned his meals, and they actually did a vegetarian meal every Wednesday night for Walt, and he's still with the program today, 3 years later. So I think it's a real give and take where we're not only giving to the kids, but the kids are giving back to us. I was very much involved with service integration in the Tualatin area and the other 2 family resource centers, one in Beaverton and one in Forest Grove area. I helped the juvenile department. They came to me one day and they wanted facilitators in the juvenile court. I guess it was a little chaotic at times. And so we were able to place volunteers in the court to help with the flow of going before the judge. I was also able to place case aides, volunteers from local colleges, with the services to children and families. They would actually hire our volunteers, and so that was a real career development program also. In Polk County, we do have 6 service integration teams. We've got one way out in Falls City. We've got one in Grand Ronde, Dallas, the Central, which is Monmouth Independence, and West Salem. And each team is very unique. They're made up of representatives from state, county, and local organizations, as well as some community members. And in Grand Ronde, several of the tribal members. Teams coordinate projects at the community and the individual level. At the community level, teams will identify a gap in service or a need area. And I do go to all of these teams, so I feel it's a real use of my time offering technical support to the teams also. They may identify that they need after-school activities for youth. The team will then identify ways to work together to fill that need. The teams have flexible funds from the Polk County Commission for Children and Families to put towards identified needs. Teams also coordinate services at the individual family level. If a family is working with multiple agencies, the teams are available to help navigate that system and to ensure collaboration and avoid duplication whenever possible. Service integration also has a management level team called the Leadership Council in Polk County. This team is made up of agency management heads who meet monthly to ensure coordination of systems. Again, the partners include state, county, and local partners. The final component is the Family Resource Network. I have sort of a mini resource center just in my office. I only have 600 square feet, but I've got the Family Resource Network. I have the new Life Team Respite Coordinator. I have the Family Empowerment Project, and I've also got the Polk County Volunteer Coordinator, and we all work very closely together. The final component of the Family Resource Network, and as we brought Senator Shields down to our area, and we drove him around to tell him about the needs of homeless. And we do have a lot of homeless. We've identified up to 100 people who are in the hills just outside of Falls City. These people do come to the Family Resource Network for help, and we're able to access services and to get them connected. We just had a family about a month ago with 8 children who came out from Ohio. We were able to get them, seek them shelter, and connect them into the local agencies. A huge piece to the Family Resource Network, too, is the Dallas Ministerial Association, which is made up of the 29 Dallas churches. They contribute funds, and the Family Resource Network takes care of these funds and has the discretion of giving to the families to connect them into services. This work represents a true collaboration and would not be possible without the time, financial resources, and support from many partners, from the school districts to county services to state agencies to local private nonprofits. It originated out of a desire for increased collaboration. Partners wanted to work together and sought a vehicle for collaboration. There was a need to come together around services which may otherwise fall through the cracks. Instead of just saying, my agency doesn't do that, the need instead was to come together to brainstorm solutions for needed services. The results of these projects are many. Outcomes are seen in individual projects that are funded, as well as the benefits to individual staffing. Staff report that they are 15% more likely to know what resources to suggest to families than in the past. Spanish-speaking families also have access through a telephone translation line. I wanted to get more at a real local level by talking a little bit about what we're doing at the teams. Grand Rond, we're developing a food bank as a group. We have lunch buddies in the Grand Rond Elementary School. We've been able to get the casino employees to come, as well as the tribal employees, to come into the school and start connecting with the kids. I'm working in collaboration with the SMART program, which is at Grand Rond. I'm able to help train the volunteers, offer appreciation and recognition, and also we do the criminal record checks, so we help with the management of the volunteers. I'm going to be placing a couple of volunteers in their Coyote Club, which is a summer youth program right there in Grand Rond. Falls City, their primary need, because I am the eyes and ears on the team, they really wanted lunch buddies. So we developed a lunch buddies program in the small little Falls City Elementary School. Went to the high school, which is only 50 kids, but we were able to get their leadership club of 11 kids to come in and to help mentor the younger ones in the elementary school. Also went to a garden club, which I was surprised they had a garden club out in Falls City, and spoke one night to 30 people, and 4 people signed up that evening to be lunch buddies. In the Dallas area, we do have night court. There's 30 volunteers that work every Saturday night at the Dallas High School, where kids come to play games, to interact. It's a mentoring type program. We also have lunch buddies. We're pushing for the 100 mark in the Dallas School District. We have Dallas Action Together, which I just recently joined, and we're looking at the asset building of kids, looking more at the positives instead of always the risks. I help manage the volunteers in a domestic violence shelter, also the ones at the local food bank. We have the Central Service Integration Team, and we have lunch buddies, and we're putting students from Western Oregon University, there's people from the police department, into the school. I'm also working on helping to develop a family resource center, which I did back in the 80s with Senator Shields, where we're having a resource center for the people. We're surveying people to see what their needs are. And then I'm working with partners to bring them into the resource center. The employment department, adult and family services, services to children and families, we've been really instrumental in bringing them into the resource center. They're doing supervised visits of the kids who are in SDS care right now. West Salem has a unique service integration team where we're going down to the people at the local level. We're actually going to the apartment complexes, and we're holding mini fairs, and they're resource fairs. And we're doing surveys of the moms and the dads in the area to see what they would like. And it's amazing what's coming up out of the surveys. It's not always what we think they want. And so we're working with what they want, and we're bringing things down to a more local level. I just made a connection with one of our CPT staff here, as a matter of fact, yesterday, who's in a Kiwanis in West Salem, and I was telling her about the West Salem Service Integration Team. And so this is how you make things happen. You talk, and you just bring people together. I did talk this morning, as a matter of fact, some of this speech is from a principal who talked this morning. I said I would have loved to have brought you this afternoon, but the next best thing was bringing some of her speech and conveying what she had talked about. I talked to her just after this morning's meeting, and I thought, well, maybe we could get together with Western Oregon University, and they've got social psych, and they've got education majors. Maybe we could get a multidisciplinary team to put three or four of the students in every classroom in our community, and maybe we could use Department of Human Resources to help train these students. That would be a wonderful collaborative approach. Have more eyes and ears in the classroom so that we can mentor, tutor, and listen to the kids. I think we've got a wealth of knowledge and information out there, and I think to bring us all together. She said she would love to do it, but I think I might have a new project here down the road. Very much involved in the welfare to work and workforce development. It's a very large collaborative approach. We've got Temecula Community College, the Jobs Council, and we've got Health and Family Services, as well as the Community Partnership Team. We actually place moms and dads as volunteers out in the community to get work experience. I just recently had a recognition event 2 weeks ago, and four of the moms came to the recognition event, and I heard the AFS worker had said to me that they didn't feel that they were worthy to come and get recognized. But they came, we celebrated, they had cake, and we gave them certificates. And they just had a glow on their face. And that makes it all worth it when you see that. I also had a Jobs Plus client in my office who is there for 6 months, and she basically has done administrative support. I'm helping her with her resume right now and helping her to do job search. We've done a lot with the homeless in our county. About a month ago, I had a program come to me. They were called Neighbors Helping Neighbors, primarily seniors who have been working for 8 years on trying to get shelter and transitional housing going in the Monmouth area. They've actually raised $40,000, and they've bought some sites where they want to build homeless shelters, and they were seeking help. So I was able to hook them into the Housing Collaborative, which is happening between Marion and Polk County, and it's a larger group of people who go after federal dollars, HUD dollars. Also hooked them into the Independence Resource Center. So that was really critical, that if they were going to build the shelter, that the families had somewhere to go during the daytime. So it is all about connections, and it's been fun doing a lot of that. Around the mentoring, this started a program called Caring Buddies in residential group homes with seniors. I love that buddy concept, and it really works, and it's basically placing volunteers in nursing homes and residential care facilities. I also saw, and I know Representative Loken had mentioned at one point, with seniors. I also saw that there weren't a lot of volunteers in the home. So this is a way to get people to connect. Our local juvenile department is very interested in getting some of the kids who are through the juvenile department to be caring buddies in some of the local homes. We've got a gentleman out in the Monmouth area who writes Western novels, and he comes in once a week and he reads his novels to the seniors and the disabled who are in the Independence Care Center. And so it's just a way of giving back. We've also got a mother-daughter team that comes in. So I'm really working on doing more with the mentoring for seniors also. What really happened up in Washington County, I'm very proud of. Several years ago, several agencies came to me wanting to know how to start up mentoring. And so we started as a small group just having lunch. There were like five. By our third meeting, we had 25 agencies sitting around the table. And so people wanted support. They wanted technical support and just to come together to talk about the issues around mentoring. Well, it blossomed. It got so large that we actually went tri-county. It's up to 87 agencies now, Portland Metro Mentor Tutor Coalition, and Washington Mutual funds $2,000 a year to help with training. Well, I came down in this area, moved down about a year ago, and thought, well, geez, this would be great for Marion and Polk County. So with the commissions on children and family, both in Marion and Polk County, plus the Department of Human Resources Community Partnership Team, Marion and Polk County, we sat down, we brainstormed, we said, we're going to do it down here. Well, we've had three meetings, we're up to 40 agencies already, and people coming together around mentoring. We have RSVP as part of it. It crosses all age lines. We've got the juvenile department. Hillcrest comes as part of our coalition. People are reaching out, wanting to connect with each other. We've already started a directory. And a large piece to this, and what I have heard, is that they want to be trained, not only the volunteers, but the coordinators. So we started training, and what we've been able to do is to pull in a lot of DHR staff to help with the training, which is great. I've had people from the communications unit come, people from the Office of Alcohol and Drug and talk about substance abuse. We've had the National Guard as part of our training. And I think that's a unique position that we can be in, where we can train. And it's a train the trainer, and then it'll pass along for generations to come. I just really believe in utilizing everyone's talents around us.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
When you put this coalition together of agencies, that, and it sounds like you're doing a good job with all the agencies that came together, help me to understand how this happened. You're talking about training. These people from the different agencies presumably would choose one or so people that would be the person that handles the mentoring program. They're trained, and then they get volunteers to be mentors. And how exactly?
Well, Madam Chair, it's a variety of ways. A lot of agencies already have volunteer coordinators mm-hmm. that will train volunteers. This is just an extra piece that we're able to give. We do have free training. I'm able to go out and get dollars. I wrote a mini grant to Adult and Family Services. They just gave us $600 for a recent training. Our Polk County Commission on Children and Families had given us training. I've already asked Washington Mutual, too, because they are down in this area. I feel that if we just ask, people give. So we're opening it up for all volunteers from all of these agencies, a one-day training. We held one in the fall, and we just held one 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we feed people, and we give them certificates. And
and then these people mentor kids like your lunch buddies and your what do they do? What do the mentors do?
Well, they're out. Madam Chair, they're out in the community. A lot of them are lunch buddies. I had people from the SMART program in Grand Ronde. Three came to the last training,
mm-hmm.
and that's Start Making a Reader Today.
Yeah.
And so that's a service that I'm able to offer their volunteers. We had people from the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program. They came to our training. So it's just people who are out in the community who are mentoring in a lot of different ways. I just feel that we have the capacity to have this
brown. Okay. Mm-hmm. Representative Brown,
Madam Chair,
I'm really impressed with the breadth and just the quantity of activities that you're involved in. With the people that are in your area, do you see a lot of addiction, drug and alcohol problems, and do you, is there enough access to treatment for those people who need it?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Ross, I might have to let Jerry Weeks talk a little bit about that. I think just from running homeless family programs and developing a huge network up in the Portland area, it is very prevalent. And I think the key is, in my role, I can train people who are mentors around substance abuse issues and then give them the resources where to refer people. So we do train on information and referral and just to refer back to us. But I think it is across the board. But
Jerry, when you say there's enough access to treatment in both counties,
I think we're getting better than we were in the 80s. I know we didn't have a lot of access to alcohol and drug programs, but I think we're getting better at that. I know there's beds that are full, and so there's waiting lists.
Yeah. I'm sure Representative Ross, and that's part of our budget request, as you know, is a substantial increase in the prevention, intervention, and treatment capacity, which I hope will come from this committee. It's a really across the state. We don't have enough outpatient or residential. And one of the things that we're also trying to look at very carefully, Barbara Somaglia, is in many cases, we don't need to do residential treatment. It's the high-end cost kind of treatment. And we need to see, you know, to what extent we're actually buying residential capacity when we could get more in outpatient capacity for certain kinds of people that have an addiction problem and get a better buy for our dollars and stuff. And I say that carefully because I don't want all the residential treatment people to say we're not going to be residential. But we do have to continue to look at that mix of residential and outpatient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Madam Chair, just a few years back when I was in touch with an elementary school teacher in the Dallas area, he was very concerned about the number of children who were coming to kindergarten in first grade with parents who had addiction problems and the real difficulty that caused for these very young children. And at that time, it didn't sound like we were doing a very good job, all of us. Not you, but all of us, of getting those parents to treatment.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Ross, I think it's nearly 80% of the kids who take into foster care come from a home where one or both parents are using and abusing alcohol or drugs, or both.
I might add, Chair Keetub and Representative Ross, is that two of our current service integration projects, and perhaps more in the future, are designed to build a community system alcohol and drug prevention, intervention, and treatment, so that you have a network or a coalition overseeing a systemic or a organized way of doing those kinds of services and supports for gun owners.
And when we heard testimony earlier of the people who had gotten off AFS, as they were relating their histories, many of them had sometimes tried two or three times to get off their addiction, and that part of their success was and getting enough support that they were successful.
Right. And Madam Chair and Representative Ross, that's why part of the drug and alcohol package is not just a treatment package. It includes even money to develop transitional housing for people who are leaving treatment programs and can't go back to where they lived before, go back to a spouse or a boyfriend or a girlfriend who is providing the drugs or the alcohol and so on. And so part of that package is to actually take some of the money and leverage it with housing and community services and get about a 10-to-1 match and build some transitional housing for people to go from treatment to transition and then out to the community at large.
Thank you.
Are you at a point?
I wanted to give a success story of how we had a really good collaborative approach. Heard that starting July 1st, we're going to have transportation in Polk County. We did a call to action last fall where people came together and they said, we've got to make this happen. And so the agencies, SEF, AFS, they were sitting down at the table, Voc Rehab and Disability Services, trying to pool together dollars along with the Salem Transit to to make this happen, and we are making it happen. It's going to start July 1. So that was a real success story. So we are about partnerships and working together.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would just close our presentation with that community partnership team, we really do believe in our vision that we can get better outcomes for all types of Oregonians by pulling people together, pulling resources together, reorganizing the way in which agencies work together. And Judy has just described to you many different ways in which we do that on the ground, through projects, through our local offices, working with a wide range of partners and consumers. We look forward to continuing that work on pulling together all the different parts of the human services industry so it works better together.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we're going to move to more of the administration. I'll ask Bobby Mintz and Greg Wilson to come up to the table.
See if there's room for Kelly up here. So,
yeah, that's
both of us sit down.
I think you may want to get a haircut.
I'm Bob Mintz. I'm deputy director of the department, and we're going to start over the next little over a day of your hearings. We'll talk about department-wide administration. And there's two parts of that we're going to talk about. The first part will be something you've already heard about, and that is the program support and administration in each of the divisions and the importance of that program support to the division, the administration, and the division. And then we're going to spend some time on department-wide support services. And I'll be talking about what we have, what Gary and I have in our office, the director's office, and Doug will be talking about what we do in finance and personnel and policy. John Cuddy's here to talk to you about our Office of Information Systems, and Jan Dennison's here to talk to you about what we do for the consumer rep for the governor's office. I know many of you have done business with her around consumer issues. The first thing I guess I got to re-emphasize, you already know it, but we're a huge department and we've got lots of things going on in our department, and we affect hundreds of thousands of people with our program. We have a $7.2 billion request into you, and the point here is that given the diversity of our department, the size of our department, we need a well-qualified cadre of people administering the department, not only in the support services arena, but also in the programmatic side of the department. And as you all know from hearing the divisions when they came before you, is each of the divisions has a core support in the central office. It helps the field staff, helps our contractors and our partners in the counties do their job. And as you can see on page 29, some of the functions that they have in their offices are identified there. The first bullet is organizational mission, goals, and development. And what we're talking about here is not only what Gary and I asked the division to do around integration, around partnership, around performance measures, and about how we want to do business in the department for as good outcomes as we can get for our clients. It's also working with the governor's office, working with the legislature, listening to what the federal government has to do, and structuring our organization around those mandates. Some examples of that are welfare to work, the system of care program, adoption of the Safe Families Act, things that the innovative things we've done in seniors that you all have contributed to in seniors, and the closing of Fairview, just some of the things we have to deal with in our goals development. And we accomplish that with that central office staff through interdepartmental cooperation and coordination, and also interdepartmental. We work with people outside our department. And if I could just take the Adoption of the Safe Families Act as an example of that, not only in FCF do we have to think about what we're going to do with the kids we have to find permanent places for, but in order to do that within our department, we have to think about additional A&D services that we need for those folks. We have to think about more mental health services that we may need for them, Jobs Plus services, other public welfare services that we need to really help families along either to be able to take their children back and keep them safe and nurture them, or else move on and find another permanent home. Outside of a department, for that one example, we'd have to deal with the housing agency. We'd have to deal with the Justice Department and make sure the courts are able to handle that workload, and also with the Attorney General and the District Attorney. So that's just an example of some of the things we have to do. And the folks that we have in our central offices are coordinating that to make sure that we do that as a state government together. I think that spills over to the next bullet, policy development and program design. And what we try to do there in the program design is bring the consistency that the federal government and our state laws require of us, but at the same time providing the flexibility so we can do some of the things that you saw in that chart that left. Be flexible enough to do those things as well. And our program development and design folks have that charge from Gary and from me and from our administrators to be able to do that. And then a real management issue is the overall management coordination of the field structures. That's really important to make sure our field structures are doing what we want them to do and following the policy that you all set for us, the policy Gary and I want them to do. But at the same time doing that is being able to listen to the field people as we're developing those policies to make sure it's reasonable. And the overall management coordination of field structures is not just a divisional stovepipe as well. Get back to the doctrines of safe families, that field structure from SCF and from Adult and Family Services, the county mental health structures, the A&D structures we have in place, all have to be coordinated at the local level to make this work right. And our field managers are charged with that. Our field managers, part of their job description is to work with our partners in the field to do that. And part of our central office's responsibilities is to make sure they are doing that. So we have a field management structure here in Salem to oversee that. Organizational performance, Gary talked about that earlier, how important outcome-based performance is to us. And we look at performance of the divisions, not only how they're performing for those things specifically identified for them, but how well they're helping other folks within our department achieve their mission and how well they're helping the communities to achieve the missions that we all want. Resource management, the next bullet, is something that Doug will get into more. But in each of the divisions, we have people monitoring budget execution. Once you give us a budget and we set in place the ways that we're going to operate the next biennium, we have people continually monitoring how we're doing with that budget to make sure we don't overspend. And as you know, we come to you every 6 months for a rebalance. These are the folks that do the work for that rebalance, figuring out where we have savings, where we have overruns, and try to balance that. These folks have done a good job. As you know, over the last couple of biennia, we haven't asked for any money out of the general purpose fee fund, and it's worked very well for us. Revenue recovery and auditing, one of the things about a $7.2 billion budget, and you all know that at least 78% of that budget is in direct payout to people delivering services or to grants to clients. We don't have people in Salem writing checks. We have a computer writing checks when we send them out. And the only way the computer can do that right is if people in the field structures enter the right data into the computer. We have some people working to take care of mistakes that happen. So if we have overpaid a benefit, overpaid a provider, we catch that. We have people looking for those kinds of things, and we work on that. Also, revenue recovery means that we're doing a good job of getting all the federal dollars we can have and always exploring ways we can get new federal dollars. And over the years, we've been pretty successful at that. And quality assurance goes without saying that we want the best quality programs we have, and that goes to the licensing function we have in our central offices. It goes into the review functions we have. And I'll point to you in the seniors program, we do reviews of the programs that we contract with regularly about the quality of care we have. We do that as well in SCF. Gary and I told the SCF people that we wanted a branch review in addition to our contractors. We wanted a comprehensive branch review at least once a biennium for the 39 branches, or 41 branches in SCF now. And we've got that in place now. So this quality assurance means not only for purchase of care folks, which that's very important, but it also means for our staff. And customer service is the bottom line for quality assurance, that we have good customer service and quality outcomes for our clients. And Gary and I, when we go out, we have community meetings, listening to people about how it's going. Jen Dennison, as you know, gets lots of phone calls. You get lots of phone calls. And so this is a data collection point for us, trying to figure out how we can do a better job. Now, I got to tell you, we can do a better job in quality assurance and customer service, and I'm going to talk about that a little later when we get to internal auditing. Internal auditing has a function there. And then on page 30, there's a pie chart that shows you our total budget and where we spent it. And you've already heard this before, and what we're talking about today is up in the right-hand portion where it says program admin in divisions, 3.71%. In DWSS, that stands for Department-Wide Support Services, 1.66%. And that's what we're talking about. And at the bottom of page 30 on the right-hand side, you can see Program Support and Administration. I've just been talking about the first bullet there and how important that is for our divisions and our overall administration of the department to make sure we have that well-coordinated expertise that we need in each of these areas. Each of these areas, you know, are very complicated. The Jobs Plus program is complicated. Child welfare program is complicated. Not one person can have all that knowledge. So we have a whole cadre of people just working on that first bullet. We get to page 31 now. We're going to talk about Gary's office, my office, the office of director and deputy director, and some of the things we do out of our office for department-wide administration. And then we'll get into the stuff that we do with computers and personnel and the like after that. The main thing that Gary and I do personally is coordinate our activities with the governor's office and with the legislature to make sure that we're kind of in step with what the policymakers, our bosses, want us to do. And we deal with advocacy groups to hear what they think we ought to do, and we try to balance everything. We listen to the people we contract with, and we listen to our customers and our staff about how we need to manage the department. As you can see here, we have several things in addition to what Gary and I do that we handle, and they are direct reports to Gary and me, and I really focus on these things. And you can see the facilities management, communications, internal audit, liaison with the tribal government, the governor's advocacy office, legislative coordination, and department diversity. And department diversity is important for us. If you look at diversity in state government, we kind of lead the way in a diverse workforce. That's important for us because we serve people in human services, and we need a workforce that reflects the people we serve. And so we have a person dedicated to that that works directly for Gary and me, works on our affirmative action plan, cultural awareness, and we do have an annual diversity conference where we bring staff in and train them about the importance of that. And also, this is something that we really focus on with our contractors as well. Now, Gary's talked to you in the past about integration, partnerships, and outcome performance. And one of the tools we have is facilities management. The way we manage our facilities really augments the achievement of those things I just mentioned. We have 134 field offices in DHR all over the state. And we can manage them where each of the divisions have an office in a city or a county, or we can manage them so that we're located together in a more user-friendly environment, and we can manage them so that we're there not only with our divisions, but with other state agencies that are closely connected with us, and also the county governments and the city governments and our contractors. And that's what we're trying to do. We have some great examples about how we're managing facilities in a new way, in that everybody's lumped together. One example is the site we have in White City, where we have our divisions there, we have school counselors there, we have county health there, we have county mental health there, we have our providers there, we have community policing there, we have the employment department there, and they're all there. I mean, what they try to do is serve the customers in a very holistic way. And if you look at the Medford area and the way we were configured before we started that project, people who were really kind of strapped for daily living and survival and to bring it together had to travel all over the city of Medford in order to find services. And that's not an easy thing to do for somebody who's under stress and under a serious situation of poverty or whatever it may be. The other point of it is when we see a person in human services, they usually have more than one presenting problem. As an example, if we have a child welfare client, there's usually something else going on there just other than child welfare, whether it be unemployment, alcohol and drug use, abuse, or whether it may be a mental health issue. There's all kinds of things can be going on there. So what we try to do is get all these folks together in one place so they can talk informally and formally about how we can better serve our clients. So facilities management is a very, very key tool to use in some of the things that Gary and I are trying to achieve in the department. Also, this group manages the building we're in at Salem. We have the government help us manage that. Another very important tool in life in the director's office is our communications function. And one of the things about, we're trying to go through a cultural change at the department and trying to get people to think about partnerships and integration and quit thinking about the ways they've done business for the last 20 years and think about something new. And the greatest obstacle you have is getting that communicated from our office down to the line staff and down to the staff that do things on contract for us. And communication is the key. So we have a small group of individuals who work with the internal communications that we need with our staff and with our partners. Some examples of what they're working on now are talking about integration and partnership. They're talking about teen pregnancy prevention. They're talking about respite care. They're talking to us about the need for alcohol and drug services, how to better access alcohol and drug services, talking about the children's safety net programs and how people can access services through that. And the last thing that's on their plate right now, we just gave it to them a few months ago, is talking about year 2000 and our readiness for year 2000, what to expect from us, and if there is a problem, where to go. So communication is a very, very important component of our initiative for integration and partnership. Now, I mentioned earlier that that we can do better in customer service and quality assurance, and this is it, internal audit. Traditionally, in DHR, and I'm almost embarrassed to tell you this, is that for an agency of more than 9,000 of employees and thousands of contracts we have out there that are helping us do our work, we have traditionally had one internal auditor to look at the systems that we have, administrative systems we have, support structure systems that we have, to make sure things are working efficiently and if things are going wrong. So Gary and I, how we can fix it quickly sooner rather than later. And what we've done is really tried to, within our means right now, to beef that up. And what we've done is develop an audit committee, which I chair, and we have the deputy administrators from each of the divisions sitting with me in the audit committee and the one internal auditor we have right now. Talking about the highest risk situations for the state of Oregon in our department that we can address through internal audits. Some of the things we're talking about right now that we're working on, the first thing we're working on is computer security. Security of the computer is really, really important. If we're pumping out over 78% of our $7.2 million to that computer, we got to make sure it's secure and only the right people are accessing it. And I got to tell you, we have some things we need to strengthen there. We don't think there's any fraud going on, but it could happen the way because there aren't the checks and balances there that we need right now. And that was turned up through the internal audit function. Another thing that's on our list to do are benefit recoveries. How are we doing with overpayments? Are we getting them back? Those kinds of things. Contracting. If we get a provider, if we get one provider that says, you know, I haven't been paid in 60 or 90 days, I bet you there's another provider out there somewhere that hasn't been paid as well. And we need to look at those systems. And our internal audit will be looking at that when we get the resources to do it. Quality assurance. How are we assuring quality? What kind of quality assurance mechanisms do we have in the department? We want the internal auditor to measure those. Why are they? And are they effective? And if they aren't effective, what kind of recommendations will the internal auditor have to help us make them more effective? Client trust funds. For the people in the state hospital or Fairview or people in the care of SCF, we have trust funds for them. They have small amounts of money that we keep in trust for them. We need an auditor to look at that periodically to make sure those monies are being cared for properly and well spent. One of the things that we have on our list is take a look at our in-state travel, whether or not we're traveling to the right places, whether or not we need to travel as much as we do in out-of-state travel. And then the last thing that we, not the last thing, but another thing I want to mention to you is purchasing. We do a lot of purchasing in our department, and the divisions historically have done purchasing. They have different policies and procedures and ways of doing purchasing. We want the internal auditor to look at those things and tell Gary and me what's the most effective way to do that, are the ways we can do it so we can make sure we're doing it at the least cost to the department. The reason this is really important, as you can see on the bottom of page 33, we have a policy package. And we're asking to add 3 positions to that internal auditor position to do the things that I mentioned and other things. We have a long list of things we can do. And I got to tell you, talking with the Secretary of State Audit Division, they really support this. John Latimer is here, by the way, if you'd like to tell you how important this is to us. And also we've been talking to the Department of Administrative Services Comptroller's Division. And we have a letter here from John Rafford, the State Comptroller, which we'll share with you. But we also have with us Janet Tinkle from that office to talk to you about why a department our size, our complex, needs to have more internal audit capacity than we currently have and why this is important. So actually, I'd like to call them up and start now, Chair. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Latimer, Director of the Audits Division. Let me start off by talking about what's happening in the auditing profession and then take that into why I've been particularly supportive of, along with John Rafford, the State Controller, of trying to have our major state agencies improve their internal audit function. As external auditors, we get accused of walking around shooting the wounded after the war is over. And to a certain extent, I suppose some of that is true. What I'm trying to do now is create a situation where the audits division itself is more proactive, trying to help agencies understand where they can mitigate risk before it happens. And so where we look for high-risk issues such as brand-new, big, high-cost construction projects, high-cost computer projects, places where there's lots of cash and people have an opportunity to walk off with some of it, we're looking at those kinds of issues in agencies and telling directors, here's the risk you face, and here are the kinds of things you can do to mitigate those risks. But we can't be everywhere, although sometimes we get accused of that. We can't be. And so we think it's important for strong internal audit function, particularly in these major agencies spending a great deal of money with very large organizations. One of the things we're doing, where an internal auditor, particularly the Department of Human Resources, can help, as we go in and, for example, we recently finished an audit of the Medicaid Management Information System. And as we were finding issues and problems with that system, we were talking to Gary's staff about them, and they were walking right along behind us fixing those problems. We think that's a much more effective way for us to operate, rather wait till the end, have these problems keep getting bigger and bigger, and then costing more money to fix. I remember several years ago, and I think it was shortly after Gary became director. I'm old, my memory's gone, but I was sitting on that side staffing the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology.
I remember that.
Do you remember that one? And Gary walked in to politely tell us that he was pulling a plug on a $19 million computer system. And people swallowed real hard. But, you know, I have to give Gary credit because rather than trying to keep going, spending more money after bad, he made the decision, this isn't going to work, we got to stop it now, and he did. A good internal audit function with well-trained internal auditors, and I'm going to emphasize that, would be reporting to the director, and that's important, would be able to head that kind of thing off at the pass and say, look, Mr. Director, you have a very high-risk problem here. Here's why. Here's what it's going to cost. Here's what's going to happen if it fails, and here's why it might fail. And you can give directors early warning. If they'd had that warning, $19 million can go a long way to pay for internal audit function. What is happening in the private sector is that because everything is changing so rapidly in our world today, I mean, we're moving to electronic commerce. We're using the computer to do just about everything anymore. The private sector is using internal auditors now as a management tool to assess management risk, downside risk that affects the bottom line. We can do that in government also. What happens when an internal auditor is able to very quickly assess and find those kinds of internal risks, they save a lot of money, and that money can then be used for providing services to the agency's client. We've got lots and lots of examples where not only do we think that internal auditors could have prevented some of the things we found, but also internal auditors can come in after we're finished with a report and help the director understand what kinds of risks need to be mitigated and how they can go about doing that so they don't have the problem in the future. So I don't want to speak for John Radford, but John is the controller and Jana is his deputy, have been working with us very closely to try and promote the notion of strong internal audit function in the agency. Unfortunately, there's a downside to my story. We did an audit of internal auditing before I went over there, but some time ago, and what we found was that internal auditors weren't being used as internal auditors. Not only that, but by and large, many of them aren't as well trained as they could be. And so that's my caveat when I say that I think we can use good internal auditors in Oregon state government. They have to report high enough in the organization to make a difference. They have to be well trained. That means that they're probably expensive kind of people to have. And they have to be listened to. If directors don't listen to them, it doesn't matter how well trained they are or how much good work they do, nothing will happen. So that's my caveat.
And I'm Jana Tindall from the State Controller's Division and the Assistant Administrator. And you do have a letter from John Radford, and he apologizes for not being able to attend. Just pretty much echo what Mr. Latimer has said as far as our intent and support of this. We'd like to see more agencies come in with this kind of a package. And not only from the financial side, but also from the programmatic side, I think you've heard how complex the EHR agencies are and the kind of pitfalls that they can run into. The advantage of an internal auditor is that they can come in and be the eyes and the ears for the director, raise the yellow flag before the audit division comes in with a red flag and get the problems fixed when they start rather than after they've committed a lot of money and resources needlessly. So, concludes my remarks.
I would have a question about, John, what you talked about, auditors being well trained. And I was just thinking in my mind about how an auditor works in the private sector. They're essentially trained to be an auditor, and then they go to all kinds of strange places. In other words, strange to them in the sense of they don't know the business, or you don't really have to know the business to follow and audit things. Would that be the same in government, in the public sector?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, it is. The difference between a governmental auditor and a private sector auditor is very minimal. They all follow the same standards, national standards. The difference really is in governmental accounting versus private sector accounting. We do in government fund accounting, and although that's changing slowly, That's the major difference. But a well-trained auditor in the public sector follows the same standards. It's required to have the same education requirements and to do the same kind of work.
And I asked that question just because I was thinking about, you know, the complexities and the different ways that funds are used and matched and, well, and all the little ways we figure out to get funds you know, how we can make them do federal matches and things like that you know, to follow the money.
Madam Chair, one of the things that I've learned a lot in the last 2 years since I've gone across the street, but one of the things that I've discovered is that there is a lot of training that goes into to auditing. And the way the profession is going is towards risk assessment and more management consulting, both in the private sector and now more and more in the public sector also, trying to get people ahead of the game rather than coming in and saying, look at this big mess you've got. Coming in and saying, look how you can mitigate these issues or problems before they happen.
Madam Chair, could I just offer my perspective on this too, because, and I really appreciate both John and Dana being here supporting us on this. It's taken me 4 years to get this in front of you, frankly, because I had a lot of other issues to deal with in my first 4 years, not because I hadn't worried about it. In fact, we don't have an internal audit program, but I want to, I guess, support what John said too about the internal auditors capacity to be a management tool. I mostly want this staff to be there to identify the risks for me as the manager of this agency. What are the highest risks in this agency, whether it be in information systems or in some payment program or whatever? And we don't have that capacity right now. I feel like I'm flying blind from a financial perspective. We've got good accounting people and we've got good purchasing people and so on, but we don't have somebody who's the internal auditor who's looking over this whole system and saying, you have considerable risk here, 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 and here, and in order to avoid that risk, you need to do A, B, C, and D. And I've always viewed the audits process, John's as well as Dash's, as something that I wasn't afraid of, that I welcomed. I mean, I want the auditor to be there. I want to find out if they have a problem before we're in so far over our heads we're not going to ever get out. And this is my fourth agency. It's the only time I've never had more than one internal auditor. At the lottery, which is 400 people and considerably smaller than this, I had two full-time internal auditors that were good, very good. In fact, I just hired one of them to come to work for us 2 weeks ago, John knows. And that was at a very small agency. Here we're running the largest agency in the state government with a single internal auditor for this entire agency. And it is just too much like flying blind. So my hope is that we'll be able to begin to build a good and functioning internal audit. And there's a selfish reason too, which John may or may not appreciate, and that is if we have a very good internal audit program, my internal auditors are going to be working with the staff of these two other agencies, and I can cut my audit costs down dramatically if I can have everything ready when John sends his folks in. They've already approved our work papers and our strategies and everything. I'm going to reduce dramatically the amount of time that I've got auditors from both these folks in my shop, because they will have already known what kind of work we're doing, and that's a purely selfish reason for doing it. I cut my costs dramatically, so, and I had that relationship with audits when I was in insurance and finance and the state lottery. So.
Well, I just want to say I'm glad that the internal auditors are hiring at your level and report to the director, because I remember a couple of years ago the auditors were critical of the division of your department, and the division manager was very defensive and was not ready to admit that the computer system was out of date and the collection from the providers were not up to date. So now that it's at your level, you can monitor your division manager's operations and provide monitoring and better control. So I'm glad it's being higher at your level.
That's
you know directly the problem.
The other thing that I would say that I noticed, you know, when looking at this, and I'm kidding, answered that question there. This is a policy package for internal auditors, but as I looked at $283,152 in the big scheme of things of $7 billion, hopefully we don't need to add these, but that it can be somehow made a priority and within, you know, it seems to me that a little over $200,000 could be found within a $7 billion budget, realizing that that is an all general fund. I understand that's federal funds too, but.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Remember, you've already asked me to identify $20 million worth of,
right.
So I suppose $200,000 more among friends is not. Not a lot, but there.
Gary,
thank you.
What is 200,000?
That's right. Thank you.
Among friends.
That's right.
No, Madam, I have something to that.
Yeah.
If you actually look at their budget, they did carve out this 283,000 out of their existing resources.
I
as was a priority.
Katie told me, so I was.
So they've already done
that. I wasn't. Speaking out of turn here.
Thank you.
But that's right. Thank you. Representative Ross, you go.
Well, I think they're doing such a good job there. They deserve a bonus, so you ought to add it back.
They are doing a good job, but we're not adding it back.
You got to reward good behavior.
That's right.
Madam Chair, one of the things I just wanted to tell you is our first priority in hiring these new people will be somebody with an internal audit specialty in information systems.
Oh, good.
That'll be a top priority. Now, rather than me talking on and on, I think Jen Dennison has some real good information for you.
Dr. Covenant. Are we going to be cutting you short in 6 minutes? I'll bet we are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can talk really fast. For the record, I'm Jen Dennison, Director of the Governor's Advocacy Children's Ombudsman and District Resolution Office. Since last session, our program grew just a little bit. I wanted to tell you about the three programs within our office. In the beginning, there was the Governor's Advocacy Office, which served as the ombudsman function for all of DHR. In 1996, we took over through an interagency agreement with the Commission on Children and Families to be the Children's Ombudsman for the state. Last legislative session, the legislature passed a bill that provided funding through court filing fees for district resolution public policy folks to replace the state agencies. Department of Human Resources was one of the four agencies that a district resolution coordinator was placed. That person is housed in our office. There are a total of 7 staff in my office, including the district resolution coordinator. This last year, our business grew. When I did the statistics, it was like, oh my, how did we do that one more time? There was a total of 4,800 citizen cases that our staff worked on to provide resolution. Unfortunately, this isn't always a happy or pleasant outcome for the person who contacts us. A lot of you call my office and ask for assistance with your constituency, and we do appreciate that contact from you. In addition to that, there were almost 6,000 calls that we tracked in a telephone log of folks who need information or direction. Our 800 telephone line works throughout the United States. A lot of the families that we provide services for have family members that are outside of the state, and we get, especially with services to children and families, contacts from those folks asking what's happening with our family. Even though they're not a party to the case and we can't tell them in-depth information, we can let them know that things are progressing as they should or not as they should and what action they could take on behalf of that family member. There is a pie chart that shows you kind of a breakout of the contacts. Legislative requests to our office is 1% of the total volume to our office. Child welfare issues is only 11%, and that would include services to children and family issues. Our largest customers are benefits for all the division programs, as well as the Oregon Health Plan is another large customer. We have a staff person who serves as our ombudsman assistant who provides information on CHIP, CEOP, and the Oregon Health Plan, what the eligibility criteria is and how to apply for those services with those programs. Our ombudsman staff are divided by divisions because each of them has specialty areas. My background is in medicine and medical office administration, as well as running an employment agency. So I kind of look at personnel issues, medical issues, in the social service function. I have a staff person who also has worked in the medical field, and she has worked for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and she does all of the ombudsman work for mental health, ED services, and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. I have a person whose background is in law enforcement. He was a real valuable addition to our staff because of the complexity of issues involving services to children and families, and we used his skills a lot. I have another person who has over 22 years with the state, and she has worked for almost every one of our divisions, and her expertise in teaching the rest of us how to access the database in the system for all our divisions has been very invaluable. We can look at the client data screen for every client that's receiving services in the Department of Human Resources and find out what's happened with their benefits if they've called. If they called and said, my worker said my food stamps would be here yesterday and I don't have access yet, what's happened? We can look in the screen and see how the food stamps have been issued. If they haven't, we're on the phone to that branch to find out how quickly that can take place for that citizen. Of our staff together, we have over 22 years of experience as ombudsman, which is pretty amazing when you look at our program's been running at DHR since 1993. I have 9 years, which is a pretty sizable amount as well. On pages 31 and 32 of your packet, as we were going through it, the family that's described there is a typical family that calls our office. When they call us, they may not touch on exactly what's happening with them, but as we talk with them, because we take a holistic look at what's happening with our families, we find out what's going on with them, how we can connect them to the services that they need, and spend a lot of time working with them. It starts at the bottom of page 31, I believe, and goes over to page 32. Mm-hmm. 35,
67, maybe.
It was the one that Bobby talked about where, top of page 32. It really says facilities management continues at the top of page 32. That's our typical family. One of the things I think that helps us all provide the best service we can to the folks we serve is that we all have a commitment and a passion providing service to the public, and a belief that if they are eligible for those services, access should be readily made available to them and get them connected to the right programs and services can be provided. I wanted to share with you just a couple of situations that we have been involved with that have made a difference. Two scenarios I want to talk about. Contact was made to our office regarding internet programs that were contributing to the promotion of children in prostitutional activities. One case involved a parent who had published a website advertising their 13-year-old son who was available for female companionship. The contact was made to DHR by a person who ran an adult website, and he contacted a media station in Portland, who then made contact with our communications team to describe what was happening. The person who ran the adult website was very concerned that this family seemed to be prostituting their son. Our communications folks referred it to me to look at. The other situation involved a man that called and said he pretended he was a 12-year-old girl on the internet, and he was in a chat room and had met a man who was prostituting his 12-year-old niece and had invited this person who was pretending to be a 12-year-old girl to join them for an encounter. As we pulled together all the pieces for these cases, we worked with the state police, we worked with the Portland Police Bureau. Both scenarios have led to an arrest of the adults involved in the case. This, I think, kind of tells us what's happening with technology and what's happening on the internet. I gained a lot of personal satisfaction from these two cases because of the end result. Unfortunately, there are children who were damaged and are in state care. We have adults who will now be punished for their crimes.
Maybe. I see you're losing them.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'm sorry to interrupt you.
And in a way, I really want to hear what your office does. So I would rather, if you don't mind, Jim, complete this on a day when we're all here and can hear it.
I'd be glad to, Madam Chair.
Okay. With that, I think what we'll do is adjourn for this afternoon, and it's Wednesday. So tomorrow we'll be back for 1 o'clock.
Thank you.